The Guardian.
Hello, you've landed on Planet Tech Weekly with me, Charles Arthur.
And me, Jemima Kish.
On this week's show...
The technology space is really becoming closer to a meritocracy. You know, if you make a great product, everyone's going to know about it.
I'll be meeting Phil Libin, chief executive and founder of Evernote and darling of the US tech startup scene. And I'll be joined by Jemima, digital correspondent of The Guardian, and by Simon Rogers, editor of The Guardian's data blog, to discuss the power of data and Simon's forthcoming book, Facts Are Sacred. And...
Okay, we didn't win any prizes, and we don't get to go to Vegas in November, but we know a lot more about a place we didn't know at all only a week ago.
And we have another email from America with Alex Kratosky, this week musing on location-based technology and an adventure race called Challenge Nation. We'll also have a tech news roundup, including rumours that Google are looking twinkle-eyed in the direction of WhatsApp and why the Beeb just can't keep hold of those gadgets.
This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. But we kick off by celebrating the joy of facts. And to do this, I'm joined in the studio by my colleague and editor of The Guardian's data blog, Simon Rogers, to discuss his new book, Facts Are Sacred. Simon, tell us how the data blog came to be, because I recall when the Free Our Data campaign was going sort of from sort of 2006, 2007 on, that we got a big load of data about locations of schools, and that I went to Emily Bell and said, this looks really interesting, we should be doing something with data. And she said, oh, that's an interesting idea. What happened for you? How did the data blog come about?
Well, I think Free Our Data really started this whole process, and it kind of helped create an atmosphere of openness around government data. It's a really influential campaign, and I don't think you get enough credit for that, Charles, so I'm going to say that now on the record. The data blog really came about for me with 9/11, which was my second day on the news desk.
At The Guardian?
At The Guardian, yeah. I'd worked on the website before, and when I got there, basically I was the most junior person on the desk, and they needed somebody to work with the graphics team, which sounded like a kind of weird demotion, but in America it's very kind of considered a proper editorial job, and we started treating kind of graphics as if they were editorial products, and I just started collecting all this data, and I found that I had tons and tons of data, because the first time you look for carbon emissions, it's a complete pain in the neck to find. The second time, you've already got it there. And so we started saying, well, maybe we should just publish this data and see who'd be interested in it. And thanks to Emily Bell and Alan Rusbridger, who were kind of very supportive of the idea. And it all came around the launch of the Open Platform, which is the idea of opening up The Guardian, you know, open journalism and sharing our work. We just started doing it, and the data blog launched with maybe 200 data sets. And really what they were is very short, like maybe a paragraph of text and a link to a Google spreadsheet. We had to use Google spreadsheets because we couldn't get any developer time at all. And it seemed like the cheap way to build a database. And now it's actually turned into quite a good way, because I'm sure if we built it internally, it would have, you know, collapsed by now under the weight of the amount of data we've been kind of throwing at it. And it's just, I suppose what's happened is over time, it's become more and more kind of sophisticated in the stuff we do. We do visualizations now every day, and you know, videos and animations and interactives, and just kind of work with people across The Guardian to make that data more accessible and tell those stories in the best ways we can.
So how would you describe then the purpose of the data blog? Because a lot of people would say, well, raw data, that's not actually journalism as such. That's sort of the stuff that you use and which then turns into journalism. Why aren't you doing the sort of the work of it?
Well, no, I agree with that, actually. I think the numbers on their own are just numbers. You know, it's a context that we can give them that make them powerful. And we do that. We don't just publish the numbers. And that's why we do, you know, kind of long analysis pieces to go with them. But I think there is a process, because people assume that data is just out there now and anybody can do anything with it. And there is a ton of data. There's been an amazing trend in kind of government opening up data since, you know, your campaign. But that data has got more and more granular and more difficult to deal with. So, for instance, the government released coins, you know, with a huge Treasury spending database. No living human being outside the Treasury can do anything with coins. It's almost completely impossible to use. But it's really important data. So I suppose if we can help that process of kind of bridging the awful data in the messy formats with the readers and make it accessible in that way, then that's a real thing. And I think actually the amount of work that we do, maybe, you know, 80% of our time is cleaning up messy, horrible, awful government data, and that nice bit of writing about it and visualising it is a tiny proportion of the time that we spend doing stuff.
There's some important editorial nuances, I suppose, when you're approaching a data story and deciding how you slice and dice the data, because data can appear to be inarguable. It's, you know, it's black and white. These are the numbers. You can't argue with them. But the story that's told is the story that you choose to present. It's how, which slice of that data you show to people. How can you just talk a bit about that and how you choose how you represent the data story?
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because people assume that that data's always right. I was at a thing with Andrew Adonis, who's the head of the National Statistics Authority in the UK, last week, and he said that every number they publish is wrong. Every single number, but it's the best number there is. And that's a lot of the data that we publish and that we write stories about as journalists is wrong, but it's estimates, but it's the best data there is. And I think our role, I guess, is to, you know, explain that. But I suppose we start, you know, as journalists, we start with the idea of what a story is, because I think when you get a lot of data chucked at you, the temptation is to kind of just wallow through it. And that way kind of madness lies. You've got to go into it with an idea of what the story might be. So, for instance, I know this is going back a bit in time, but the WikiLeaks data, which was, say, on Iraq, was 400,000 items. We thought we had to find an angle in that, and we could see that those within that data, there's a lot of records of deaths. So we thought, well, that'll be the thing that we'll go into. So we'll try and find a journalistic angle on that data and treat it as just any other source of information. It just happens to be numbers.
So journalists are still quite important. You need to have a journalistic editorial sensibility as well as an understanding of how to wrangle the numbers.
I mean, in a way, this, you know, this could be the saviour of traditional journalism, because you can bring traditional journalism and the idea of a story to bear on the data, which is just a load of numbers, then you've got a really powerful thing. And that's, we try and kind of pitch ourselves at that apex there. And I think that's what data journalism should be. You know, people get it confused and it's all about producing graphs and visualization. That's data visualization to me. I know this sounds like nuances, but I think it's important that it's much more than just kind of making pictures, because that's just a part of it. That's just the output. The output could be anything. It could be running a story, or, you know, just publishing a spreadsheet or anything. To me, that's the output of that data journalistic process of finding story, going into the data and kind of extracting stuff from it.
So what are the data sets that have got away? What are the ones where you said, oh, I wish I could have, you know, wish I could find this one or that one? And, you know, what are the ones where you feel that you've triumphed and that you've really captured something? I mean, I guess the WikiLeaks war logs must be a triumphant one in that sense.
Well, I suppose in a weird way, there were kind of some moments that made data, not just for us, but I think kind of, you know, around the world. And WikiLeaks is a big thing, because you couldn't get stories out of that data without kind of the techniques of data journalism. Just being able to use a spreadsheet gave you a composition of strength. I suppose that would be one. Then there's things like the riots. You know, that was where, I mean, you know, you talk about data sets to get away. What I found is, weirdly, there's always a data set out there. So, for instance, with the riots, we thought, well, what we really want is to get a list of everybody who's been arrested on riot offences. And we kind of thrashed about a bit, and we realised that actually people going into court, there were court records. That's data. We just have to get hold of it. And getting hold of it was the process for that, because we had to go to the Ministry of Justice and make them put instructions around to the courts to release this data. So I think the news has driven this, and that's what makes it interesting. You know, these are big news stories, and we've been able to find a way to tell those stories in a better way.
And how about the appetite among the public and readers for stories that we tell visually and through data, and also, I suppose, the willingness of journalists to use data visualization and number-based stories. Are we really there yet?
I think it's changed a lot since we started the blog. And when we started it, we were kind of this eccentric thing, and I had to promise it wouldn't take away from my original job, which is working the graphics team, which is a lie, because obviously it did. And then, you know, the idea of publishing graphics by other people on The Guardian would have seemed weird. And using free visualization tools, journalists producing infographics, would have been a really strange thing then. And so I think the big change has been because of the stories, so things like WikiLeaks, and, you know, and now we sit next to the news desk, we're part of the news process. And, you know, a blog that we thought would be read by maybe a few developers and a few people who are interested in data and wanted to build apps has become something with a very mainstream audience. So actually most of the people that go on the blog aren't going to do anything with the data, but they want to talk about it. And I guess part of that is, as I've said before, but you know, nobody trusts journalists now, right? We're the least trusted profession in the UK. So if we can show the workings behind our stories, that makes us more trustworthy. And I think there is an appetite there for people to see the raw numbers behind a story, because then they can believe it, and people want to believe it.
So. And we're, the Guardian isn't the only paper or news organisation that does this sort of thing, is it? I mean, you mentioned the New York Times, I think. Telegraph does as well, the Times.
I think a lot of other organisations, you know, produce amazing data visualisations. I mean, New York Times produces these gorgeous kind of Michelangelo-like data visualisations. I think the one thing that we do that's different, I suppose, is the openness about it. There are not that many groups that publish the raw data behind their work and make it available. I mean, I can think of WNYC in New York, which is a brilliant website, a tiny radio station, but a brilliant website, and the guy there called John Keefe, and he publishes the data behind his workings. But probably I can't think of anybody else that does it at the rate that we do in the West. I mean, there's a great website in Argentina called La Nación. Their data site, and it's fantastic what they've done, is because they're in a kind of a very different context of quite a repressive government, which has been, you know, reducing data. They've been manually downloading every single government data set just in case it gets turned off. So people like that are amazing. But I think the big established media, nobody else does it, because, I mean, a lot of people think, what's the point? What's the point of publishing data? Why do we want our readers to have the raw information?
Are there three indispensable services or sites that you would recommend for anyone who wanted to have a go? To have a go at creating their own.
Obviously, you have to buy the book because it tells you how to do it. I would say, you know, firstly, you need to look at the free tools that are out there. So it might be more than three. I mean, in terms of the people who are doing stuff that I like, I mentioned WNYC, I think, are fantastic, and because they really punch above their weight. So during Hurricane Sandy, they were the site to go to. They had all this brilliant kind of New York public data on, you know, way ahead of the New York Times, which takes, you know, a year to produce anything. So I think they're amazing. I think if you want beauty and grace, then obviously it's the NYT. And obviously, you know, besides us, who else would I say? I think, you know, the BBC produces some really good stuff, you know, around the data. I think they could be a bit more open about it. In terms of tools, I would say my three picks for tools, I would say Data Wrapper, which is this new thing. It's developed by these two guys in Germany. It's free visualization tool to make interactive line charts and bar charts and pie charts.
I'm writing that one down.
Okay, good. And anybody can use it. And we have a special Guardian layout, which is why our data wrap charts look so lovely. And it's free and really simple. And every week they add a new feature and it becomes more sophisticated. So I just think it's a really cool thing. Still, you know, the big boys, I mean, Google Fusion Tables is still a really brilliant mapping tool. You know, if you want to map huge data sets quickly, it's perfect for that, and you know, allows you to make kind of sophisticated maps and build them into other applications, you know, on your own without worrying about having developers working with you. And then there's a site I've been using recently called CartoDB, which is another mapping site, but it produces maps that are rather beautiful. And we did one last couple of weeks ago, which was a recreation of Jon Snow's famous cholera map, but using kind of modern techniques. And so being able to do that is just really powerful, I think, as just a journalist. You know.
Indeed, Jon Snow, the original pioneer
of
open data. Yeah.
Yeah.
Simon Rogers, author of Facts Are Sacred, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Simon Rogers, and we have a special Tech Weekly listeners offer on Simon's book at just £10 sterling. That's 50% off. Just go to guardianbookshop.co.uk/facts and use the code TECHWEEK10. That's TECHWEEK10. Offer is valid until the 3rd of May, and you'll find a link on our blog at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. And now we join Jason Phipps for a roundup of this week's technology news.
This week we heard that Google has reportedly had a $1 billion bid to buy the smartphone messaging system WhatsApp, rebuffed as it tries to expand its grasp of the chat market. The search giant said it would not comment on speculation, but the publication Digital Trends reported sources saying both parties had been in discussions for weeks and the current offer is close to $1 billion, they said. WhatsApp did not respond to requests for comment from The Guardian, though its business development chief, Neeraj Arora, told All Things Digital that the company is not holding sales talks with Google. This denial, however, did not quash the rumours. Arora was the former mergers and acquisitions chief at Google in 2010 when it made an unsuccessful $6 million bid for the then red-hot coupon company Groupon, only to be rebuffed. Arora's denial to All Things Digital did not say that sales talks between WhatsApp and Google had never taken place, however. The messaging service is reckoned to have more than 250 million users worldwide and sends more than 10 billion messages daily. Its annual revenues from app sales and subscriptions are estimated at around $100 million, and the pace of its growth would make the $1 billion price tag comparatively cheap. This week, The Guardian learnt that the Audioboo founder Mark Rock is to leave the company on the 1st of May, after being increasingly sidelined as investors and a new chief executive took over day-to-day management of the social audio service. Recently, several core users of the site have raised concern over the treatment of Rock, who officially launched the company in 2009 with funding from Channel 4's now-defunct 4IP Digital Innovation Fund. Investors brought in former Adify and Reality Digital executive Rob Proctor as chief executive in October 2012, when Rock was shunted to the role of president and asked not to work from company premises. In an email to staff this week, Rock used a shipbuilding analogy to describe how Audioboo had begun as little more than a prototype and gone on to become an increasingly polished product. He said, "We've nearly hit open seas, a time for a captain to take over. I have, after all, other ships to give shape to, and they are waiting for me." This week we learned that EE, Everything Everywhere, is to double the speed of its 4G network in 10 cities, giving the UK one of the fastest mobile internet services in the world. Smartphones will be able to transmit high-definition video as fast as fibre optic wires when EE turns up the dial, with the theoretical speed rising to 130 megabytes per second, leading, they say, to a top rate of 80 megabytes per second outside of the laboratory, faster than any current application requires. The move made possible by doubling the amount of airwaves used to carry 4G will put the UK well ahead of the US and on a level pegging with Japan. "We are ensuring that the UK remains at the forefront of the digital revolution," said EE Chief Executive Olaf Swanty. The UK obsession with smartphones and tablets appears to be firing demand for EE's faster service, despite its premium price. Its parent company owns three networks: Orange and T-Mobile, which offer slower 3G speeds, and EE, which uses 4G. And finally this week, BBC staff seem to be jinxed as they have lost 785 laptops, tablet computers and mobile phones in the past 3 years, a Freedom of Information request has revealed. Since 2010, BBC staff have misplaced or had stolen 399 laptops worth £598,500, 347 mobiles worth up to £104,000, and 39 tablets clocking up at £58,000. And there has been a marked increase in the number of missing gadgets in the last year, with 350 laptops, mobile or tablet devices lost or stolen in 2012, compared to 259 in 2011. The figures included personal property lost by BBC staff that would not be covered by the licence fee funds. The BBC separately confirmed that 170 corporation-issued laptops and tablet devices were lost or stolen in 2012, costing the licence fee payer £255,000, or the equivalent of 1,752 annual licence fees at £145.50 per household. A BBC spokesperson said, "We are very mindful that this equipment is paid for from the licence fee and we make every effort to keep the theft and loss to a minimum." The BBC has implemented a number of measures to reduce the level of crime. And for all these stories and so much more, just go to the best technology news site on the web, that's guardian.co.uk/technology. Coming up next in her email from America, Alex Krotowski muses on the importance of location-based devices. But first, if you have an insatiable curiosity for all things Guardian, but just not enough time to read, why not try the Guardian Audio Edition?
This week on the Guardian Audio Edition, Martine White is a product of British welfare, not Mick Philpott. Film star Eva Mendes, "I don't care about looking beautiful." And in this week's audio book review, we're investigating mysteries for younger listeners, with Anne Cassidy's latest, Killing Rachel. To subscribe for free, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud, iTunes and Audioboo. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
It's an urban scavenger race. It's like a 5K mixed with the Amazing Race. It's Sunday, April 7th. We're outside LA Brewing in the, I guess this is the fashion district of,
Since I've been in the US, I've delegated a significant amount of my headspace to the internet. Specifically, a significant amount of my getting around headspace, the bits that get me from point A to point Z. Life is short, and paper maps and guidebooks take up space. And when you're running around the center of a town you know very little about on an urban scavenger hunt wearing a silly outfit trying to figure out 12 location-based clues, it's best you succumb to the liquid lady voice of Google Maps audio guide and the explore facility of Foursquare. Let's just say it's essential. Last Sunday, a friend and I really rather randomly ran Challenge Nation, a US-based multi-city event that happened to have its LA date whilst both of us are in town. I want to emphasize, neither of us are from Los Angeles. Neither of us know anything about downtown. We thought, perhaps foolishly, that this would be a great way to get to know another part of the city. A bit of exercise, a bit of adventure, a bit of mental work. At the starting line, my teammate Amber and I received our list of 12 clues, all riddles or requests, which frankly meant absolutely nothing to us. Pure gobbledygook. Even the clues that weren't location-specific were over our heads because they were saturated in U.S. reference points that neither of us had. Who the heck is Trey Burke? We realized rather quickly we needed someone on the team with insider knowledge. Someone who knew this town like the back of his hand. Someone who was a bin of location-specific information who knew the answers definitively, instantly. And so we invited two new team members to join us, Foursquare and Google. The killer app of any location-specific service on the internet since 1999 has been the question, where should I go for dinner tonight? The case study has been an executive in a sharp suit landing in an airport in a foreign town, whipping out his WAP GPRS 3G device and asking exactly this. And it is a complicated question. First, where are you? Second, what do you feel like eating? Third, what is good? That's three different searches, three different pieces of information. That's a lot for a computer to comprehend. And what Amber and I did was to test this to the limit. We needed definitive answers to 12 where should I go for a dinner tonight style questions, and we didn't actually really even know what questions we were asking. Still, we needed the answers now. After all, we were racing for a prize. I fired up Foursquare. Now, I've only very recently begun using Foursquare, the smartphone app that lets users share where they are with their Foursquare friends and leave tips about the restaurant, zoo, mountaintop, coffee shop, place of interest for anyone who's thinking about going there. The most interesting thing for me in the service is the search or the explore facility, which suggests places in your immediate vicinity that people who use the app have visited. You can search by category and by keyword, and then you can read the tips that other people have left. Like many of the apps I heard about when living in London but never really found particularly satisfying, Foursquare is more useful in a place where people are using it. And here, everyone is using it. It's caught on like wildfire, and not just amongst an insular population of early adopters, but I mean everyone. So that's how I found my dentist in LA a few weeks ago. And, of course, that's how I found out about a great coffee shop around the corner. And that's pretty much how Amber and I found our way around downtown LA last Sunday. And I have to admit, our use case worked impressively well. I had a vague idea that I needed to find a Bikram studio to answer one of the clues, and so I threw Bikram into the search. And yep, a single Bikram place within a 5K radius of the race popped up on the screen. Bingo. I asked it to show me the world's shortest railway by putting world's shortest railway into the search box. Was it anywhere near me? Well, yeah. Angel's Flight, a one-block funicular-style train smack in the middle of the city, was just two blocks away. I even tested the search with a hashtag, ArtshareLA, and it delivered the goods. There are, of course, limits to its power. Amber and I and Foursquare and Google were a four-person team that day. And our four-person team finished 38th out of 189. Okay, we didn't win any prizes, and we don't get to go to Vegas in November, but we know a lot more about a place we didn't know at all only a week ago. Undoubtedly, the MVP in this scenario was Foursquare. Truly a team player. You can see all the photos and the links from the day on the Tech Weekly website at guardian.co.uk/techweekly.
And we'll have more emails from America from Alex Skrotowski in the coming weeks.
Now, one of the darlings of the tech startup scene in the US is Phil Libin, the energetic and charismatic, so I'm told, chief executive and founder of Evernote. I spoke to him this week to discuss his multipurpose notes and data application and his recently announced tie-in with Deutsche Telekom. But first, I asked Phil to summarise for us and for any listening aliens what it is Evernote does.
Well, Evernote is your external brain. We make products that try to make you smarter. It's basically a collection of apps on all of your different phones and tablets and computers and other devices, and they talk to a central Evernote service and lets you remember everything that happens to you, store all of your information, find anything that you're looking for. So it's the kind of thing that we want people to use for their lifetime memories, for now and every day of their lives.
So when you say all your information, I mean, are we talking just text? Are we taking pictures, videos? Could it be audio? What sort of, when you say all, that's quite a wide field.
It is, and we really try to be your external brain. So whatever form information is coming at you, that should be the most natural way to record it. So pictures, text, web clips, documents, audio, PDFs, kind of anything that starts out either in the real world, like you're having a great meal, you want to remember what you're eating, you can take pictures of it, and those are automatically associated with the name of the restaurant and the location and who you're with and so on. Or if you have something that starts digitally, a web page you're looking at, you can just push a button and clip it or have a document. So all your physical, all your digital information in one place and always searchable.
So I guess the challenge is, I mean, if it's anything like my brain, then it's a pretty horrendous mess. How does one organize within it?
Well, see, my brain too. That's the whole point. That's why we made it. The whole idea is, I think productivity software in the past was always limited to this very small but lucky niche population of users that happen to enjoy organizing things. There's some people who get pleasure out of putting labels on things and moving things into different folders, and there's not that many of us. Not that many of those people. The rest of us are kind of disorganized, and so we wanted Evernote to do that work for you. So if you're one of the lucky few who enjoys organization, you can certainly do that in Evernote. We have tags and labels and notebooks, but you don't have to do any of that stuff. So I don't myself. I just throw everything into Evernote, and then it's really, we see it as our job to present that information to you when you need it, not your job to have to organize it after the fact.
So what form does retrieval take? If I want to say, oh yeah, so what was that dinner that I had 3 months ago? How would I go about finding it?
Well, lots of ways. So whatever is most natural at the time, you could just look. For example, if it is a dinner, you'd probably look in Evernote Food, which is our food app, and then you could just scroll very, very nicely visually to what looks like the right dinner. Or you could, if you remember where it was, you could look at a map. If you remember, I was in Paris at the time. Or of course, you can search. You can search for the restaurant name or who you were with or any other information that was associated with it. But then once you'd found that dinner in any of these ways, if at the same time you or you had dinner with, let's say, with me and you took some notes about Evernote, it would automatically show you all of the related information. So if you found the dinner that we had together and you were looking at the dinner, it would automatically say, hey, you were here with Phil, and here's what you know about Phil. So the idea is that it surfaces your memories when you need to, trying to make you do as little organization as possible. Like it should be our job to organize your information so that it's accessible. It shouldn't really be up to the user to do it, although you certainly can if you want to.
It sort of sounds like my external brain would be a very free association one. So there's a couple of notable things that have happened. First of all, you have a deal with T-Mobile, I think, in Germany. And also Google has launched a service called Google Keep, which to a lot of people looks very like Evernote, at least in some of its ambitions. So just start with Google Keep. How much of a competitive threat do you see that as being?
Well, you know, it's hard to tell early on. I mean, I think it helps us a little bit and it hurts us a little bit. On balance, it probably helps us more than it hurts. All of devices, all of these, you know, phones, tablets, you know, computers, they all come with kind of feeder apps. They all come with nice-looking, elegant, you know, simple apps in different categories that basically serve the idea to give people, they serve the purpose of giving everyone who uses that device the idea that, hey, I can use this device for this particular thing. So, for example, the iPhone has a really nice-looking Stocks app that it's always shipped with. And, you know, does the Stocks app hurt, you know, the more professional financial management services and apps on iPhone? Like, no, it's probably the best thing that ever happened to them, right? Because now every single person who buys an iPhone gets the idea, oh, I could use this to manage my stocks. And some percentage of those people, all they need are the simple things that are done by the Stocks app, and they never move to anyone else. So it does sort of act as this low-pass filter that the really casual users stick with the built-in apps. But those are the really casual users. They're hard to you know, build a business around anyway. But as soon as you get a little bit more serious, you go and you start looking for the more robust financial applications, and you find, you know, E-Trade or Bloomberg or whatever. And the same thing for, you know, the weather category. You know, weather is this huge category of apps, and the best thing for that category is that all phones come with a simple weather app.
But how much of with Google Keep, how much of a head-on threat do you see it as being?
Well, I think it's going to be more of this feeder functionality. So now, you know, everyone who buys an Android phone will get the idea that they can use this device to remember their lives, just like they could with iPhones, because, you know, it's always had a pretty simple note-taking app, and with Blackberries and Microsoft products or whatever. So I think that for the casual users, for the ones that don't need anything more robust or more sophisticated, it will be competition. But it will result in many more advanced users, because now hundreds of millions of new people a year who otherwise wouldn't have thought to use our device for this particular use case will now think to use it. We do compete with pretty much all of our best partners. You know, every big company that we work closely with, you know, Google, Apple, Microsoft, Facebook, Amazon, you know, these are all companies that we're doing stuff with, but all of them also compete with us and with each other in some way. So it's it's not a zero-sum process. There's always competition, there's always collaboration. We try to spend as much time as possible thinking about, you know, what can we build together that's better than exists before, but there is always competition as well.
And what about the T-Mobile deal? What's the expectation with that? I'm assuming that T-Mobile is paying money to you rather than you paying money to T-Mobile.
Yeah, so we have a deal with Deutsche Telekom, and they bundle Evernote Premium, a year of Evernote Premium for free. Free to all of their subscribers, so all of their mobile subscribers, their fixed line subscribers, their broadband subscribers. Basically, if you're a DT customer in Germany, you get Evernote Premium for free for a year. Otherwise, it's 40 euros a year. It's similar to a deal that we've done in Japan with Docomo and a few other countries. And it the way it works for us is basically we do get some money from the carrier for it. But we're not really doing it for revenue that we get from the carrier. We're doing it because while we're pretty good at reaching the early adopter audience, you know, we've got about 50 million users, probably about 1.5 million in Germany. But those 1.5 million in Germany were the people who found us themselves, kind of the early adopters. But now having this included in DT and having them do the education, the promotion, really lets us talk to them, a much more mainstream German audience that we otherwise would have had a harder time reaching. So that's the real benefit for us.
So it's a sort of way of crossing the chasm, as I think it's called, with the innovator's problem.
Yeah, right, in the gorilla suit into the bowling alley, or however that works.
And what is the next step then? I mean, because I've seen, for example, Evernote on Samsung fridges, where the idea was that you'd have a household, you put a note on the fridge saying, hey, we need milk, and it pops up on someone's smartphone while they're in the supermarket or possibly before. Are there sort of other cases like that where you're sort of seeing partners come up with ideas that perhaps haven't been thought of? And this whole idea of integrating the cloud and endpoints into things that we do daily?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a big next step. This is going to happen all over the place with all of these connected devices that are coming out, which, you know, I'm extremely excited about. mostly because I'm a giant nerd, so it's easy to get for me to get excited about, you know, various gadgets. But I really do think we're on the verge as a society of another big leap in improvement of quality of life, kind of similar to the leap we had when we went to smartphones by all of these other devices. So I'm super optimistic about about glasses, about all of the fitness stuff that you wear, about, you know, refrigerators and cars and TVs and pens and watches. And I think what's going to happen is we're going to move away from the idea of writing applications for a device, and we're going to start writing applications for a particular lifestyle that just assumes you have a bunch of these devices. So it's not that, I mean, yes, there's a version of Evernote that runs on the refrigerator, but you're not meant to use it on the refrigerator, you know, and isolate it. Like, the whole point is, if you have that refrigerator, you also have a smartphone, and you have a computer, and you have other stuff. And we write Evernote so that it works across all of these connected devices. And it's a completely different design paradigm for products. Like forcing yourself not to design for a device, but to design for a person with multiple devices is a really interesting way of thinking about how to build products. And I think we're going to see this from lots of companies over the next couple of years as these things proliferate.
There certainly has been a big growth in the number of companies offering cloud services of one sort or another as a consumer or whatever offering. So there's yourselves, there's Dropbox, there's Box. One could go on. It seems to be a new wave of apps that are coming out. Is there more we should expect? I mean, you talked about lifestyle there, but you know, how do you see it developing over the next few years?
I think there's going to be tons of progress already and in the future. There's lots of things that are kind of pushing in the same direction. I think that the most exciting thing is, I think the technology space is really becoming closer to a meritocracy, you know, than we've ever seen before. I think because of social media and smartphones and app stores, because of these things that basically make it so that once you have a good product, you know, if you make a great product, everyone's going to know about it just through social media, and everyone's going to be able to get it through, you know, through app stores. So all of these barriers that of everything except for the quality of the product have been knocked down. And so that the overall quality of everything, I think, is just skyrocketing. I think people are having much better quality products now than they did, you know, 5 years ago. And that's just going to keep increasing, and it started with consumer apps, right? So it started with, you know, Evernote and Facebook and Dropbox and Angry Birds. But that meritocracy is spreading from that to everything else, to enterprise apps, to hardware products. So I think you're just going to have this vast improvement in your quality of life, or at least your quality of life of interacting with products over the next few years, as things just get better and better and encompass more and more types of devices and lifestyles.
Sounds great. So you said, I think it was 50 million users at the moment for Evernote?
Yeah. That 50 million was, you know, probably a month ago. So it probably a bit more, probably, I don't know, 52, 53 or something like that.
So if we look forward...
I haven't looked in a little bit.
If we look forward sort of 3 years or so, where would you expect to be? How many users and what sort of scale? Or are you looking to be bought by someone?
No, we're definitely not looking to be bought. In fact, we're very serious. From when we started, we said our goal is to be a 100-year startup. Like, we want to make a 100-year startup. We want to make a company that's still around in 100 years, that people are still in love with in 100 years. But also, it's not just a 100-year-old company. It's still a startup at that point. It's still making quick, agile, you know, innovative products. And we have no idea how to do that. Like, that's a big challenge. Like, how do you make a 100-year startup? That's you know, it'll take us 100 years to figure out. We're only 5 years in. So we launched about 5 years ago. So we're basically, you know, we have a progress bar at the office that shows, you know, we're at 5% towards our goal. So we definitely don't want to be bought. We want to, you know, remain independent and keep going. In terms of users, I think, you know, our ambition really is to build an external brain. And I think everyone wants that. I think there are very, very few people on the planet who say, yeah, I'm as smart as I need to be. I'm perfectly satisfied with my meat brain. So I think we're trying to build it for everyone. So I certainly want to get to 1 billion users, you know, 2 billion users, 7 billion users. It's going to take a while, but, you know, we've got 95 more years to do it.
And what's your next product? What should we expect next from you?
Well, you know, we have a few products now. We have, you know, Evernote. We have Evernote Business, which is targeted at basically using Evernote at work. We have Evernote Food and Evernote Hello and Sketch and clearly. So there's like 7 or 8 products right now that all revolve around the central Evernote service. So there's basically just different ways to use Evernote for particular important things. And we are going to be coming out with more of those. But, you know, in terms of the total amount of energy and the total amount of effort, it's much harder to take something that's already pretty good and make it a little bit better. Like that's much harder to do than just to go from nothing to something. So I think, you know, 90% of our energies are just going to be spent perpetually just constantly polishing, you know, making the existing products a tiny bit better, you know, every day. And maybe 10% of our resources are spent on doing completely new crazy things just because it's fun and relatively easy to do them. But, you know, getting Evernote on the iPhone from version 5.0, which is where it is now, to version 6.0, is probably going to take 10 times the effort that it took to get it from 0 to 1.0. Most of the work is just in small incremental improvements. We want each product to be better in 1,000 little ways, you know, every time we release it.
Phil Libin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all we have for you on the show this week. Thanks again to Phil Libin and Simon Rogers. And just to remind you, if you want to get Simon Rogers' book, Facts Are Sacred, with that special offer, you'll find a link on our blog at guardian.co.uk/techweekly.
But for me, Charles Arthur, Jemima Kish, and Tech Weekly producer Jason Phipps, catch you all next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.